Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Well, we are once again watching deadly fires ravage large areas of land in California and other parts of the country. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, there are 107 wildfires across 15 states. More than 2 million acres have been burned, and this is just the beginning of fire season. Last week, the Dixie Fire, the second largest in California's history, tore through and destroyed much of the mountain community of Greenville, leveling homes, small businesses, and schools. According to Cal Fire, the fire, which started on July 13th, has ravaged 463,000 acres. Only 21% of the blaze is contained. Jack Cagle, Operations Section Chief for the U.S. Forest Service, said these are not the normal fires anymore. It's just intense fire behavior, and it's not what we're used to. So why are catastrophic wildfires increasing in number and severity around the country and around the world? What can be done to lessen the staggering death and destruction they cause? And what lessons can we learn from the recent deadly fires? Well, these are just a few of the questions Oscar-nominated filmmaker Lucy Walker explores in her incredible new documentary, Bring Your Own Brigade. Lucy Walker's team was with firefighters in November 2018 as the Camp and Woolsey fires destroyed thousands of structures in Malibu and Paradise, California, where 88 people tragically died. The film focuses on the climate crisis, logging, indigenous communities who have managed the environment using prescribed burns, development, and a lot more. Here is the trailer for the new documentary, Bring Your Own Brigade.
I've never seen anything like it.
The fire equivalent of an ice age.
Like peering into Dante's Inferno.
And it's only going to accelerate.
It's only a beginning.
We're surrounded by fire. My dad put his hand on my shoulder and he said, don't leave.
Whatever you do, do not let that building burn down.
Evacuate.
Everything was on fire. The looks on their faces, they were sure they were gonna die.
Run for your life.
I've never seen that look in anybody's face.
The world is waking up to the hellish realization that all over this planet, wildfires are burning us alive.
Most of the people I know lost everything.
And that's why we came to be embedded with firefighters on what turned out to be the deadliest day for fires in California.
Yet again, 2 years in a row, we're caught with our pants down. You're left making decisions you don't want to make.
It was difficult. Very difficult.
Private firefighters protect people with money.
Bring your own brigade.
How you doing?
We're still here. We didn't burn them.
Blame the firefighters. Blame the environmental community.
Point fingers in other directions other than yourself.
Fire everywhere. No fire engines.
Chief, put something into action now.
Even if we believe it's climate change, which I don't, we got to do something about it.
Why do we approve building in places that are dangerous?
Logging operations are making fires burn faster and hotter.
I am not hearing this story anywhere.
This is the story.
I don't see this as a natural disaster. I see this as human error.
Fire can be our friend or it can be our enemy.
Maybe we need to go back 100 years and say they did it right and we've mismanaged it.
Treat the land with respect.
If we're at war with fire, we're going to spend a lot of money, we're going to take a lot of casualties, and we're going to lose.
And I still don't think the public understands that.
That is the trailer for the new documentary, Bring Your Own Brigade, which opens in Bay Area theaters today and will stream on the CBS News app and Paramount on August 20th. Today, we are joined by Lucy Walker, an Emmy Award-winning British film director who has twice been nominated for an Academy Award and is renowned for creating riveting, character-driven nonfiction. Hi, Lucy. Thank you so much for joining us, and huge thanks to you and your team for making this incredible documentary.
Thank you.
Well, Lucy, I just want to start off by saying, because this is such a difficult issue and it can be really depressing, frankly, the thing that was so amazing in the film is so many experts said it does not have to be this way. If we take action, this doesn't have to be our new normal, because we do so many shows about fires and air quality, and so many of our guests say this is our new normal, but experts say that is not the case.
That's right. That was a real surprise to me, actually. I had started out wanting to make a film about fires, but back then I had assumed that it was climate change. I had assumed that it was climate change that was driving these fires. And of course, that is a difficult and overwhelming problem. And right now we just got this report in, didn't we, saying that climate change is really here and certainly going to impact us. And so to learn that it wasn't just climate change that was driving these fires, and there are things that we can do differently that will really make a difference.
Well, thank you for bringing that out. It is so, so important. And we will talk about that throughout the show. So again, so many people say this does not have to be our new normal if we take action. I just wanted to start with that because it's such an important point. So let's talk a little bit about you and why you decided to make this film. I understand that you moved to California and you were just shocked that these fires were so ferocious. And you wondered, what is going on here? Why can't they just put these fires out? And that started you on this journey.
That's exactly right. I'm originally from the UK. I grew up in London, England. And then I had moved to New York City. And in both those places, fire seems like a problem that we solved already, maybe in medieval times. We had the last big fire in London in 1666, the Great Fire of London. So you think of it as something that we can solve through modern firefighting and fire engines and all those things that seem very familiar and really wonderful. And so when I moved to California, I couldn't believe it. The hillsides were on fire. I went to visit San Francisco and the air was thick with smoke. Down here in Los Angeles, there was ash all over the yard. There was just fire on the hillside that people were driving past. And I thought, oh my goodness, am I safe? I'm actually a bit of a scaredy cat when it comes to fire. I find it very frightening. And I was just curious, kind of, what's wrong with the firefighting around here, you know? Or I didn't understand it at all, to be honest, which in retrospect, forgive me and my ignorance, but perhaps that ignorance was a real excuse to actually just ask some really basic questions. And I just became fascinated with asking, well, what is it like for firefighters and residents, because I had had some friends that were caught up in the Thomas fire, and they were both firefighters and residents. So I had some really good friends, sort of family friends I'd had for years, and godmother to their daughter, and really very close family friends. And they had both firefighters and residents involved in that Thomas fire, which became the largest fire ever in California history, which is crazy because it was only 3.5 years ago, and it's now only the 7th or 8th, I think, with the Dixie Fire now. So it's only just in the top 10 now, even though at the time it was a shocking biggest one ever. And I could not believe what they were going through. They were evacuating. They didn't know if they were going to see their home again. They were stuck in traffic. They were worried about what to take. They had to then evacuate again because the fire doubled back. Meantime, with the firefighters, there was tragically a firefighter killed, and it just was so dramatic. And then even at the end, there was a terrible debris flow that killed 22 people in just a crazy, terrifying, traumatic incident where the hillside just barreled through the beautiful town of Montecito. It was just devastating. And I thought, why is nobody making a film about this? It's so dramatic and so horrific for these people. And we should know what they're going through and share those stories. And so I thought, to start with, I'll just make a film about that one incident, because that will be kind of contained. And that would be a good way of just sort of understanding the issue, but it having a kind of simple shape. And I thought, well, the cause is climate change. So I'll talk a little bit about climate change is kind of coming to California and affecting us. But I didn't think there was more to it that I had to dig into. But pretty soon when I got into it, two things happened. First of all, there was an even bigger fire. The Mendocino Complex fire came along. And I thought, oh my goodness, already the fire that was the biggest fire ever in California is now the second biggest. What is going on? This is a bigger trend. This is a bigger problem than I want to admit. But I think I should look at that bigger problem and get to the bottom of that. You know, there's no point making a film about one fire when we've already got a problem about all these fires. And the second thing that happened is, no sooner did I start talking to people about what was going on, it turned out it was not what I thought. It was not, in fact, just climate change that was driving these fires. Yes, we have had the hottest summers, and the biggest fires in these recent years. But that is not all. There are some other factors that we can impact and we are learning about. And we really focus on those in the film.
Yeah. So important. You focus on logging. You focus on the new development. You focus on indigenous practices. And it's all of this needs to be discussed because it's all so incredibly important. It was amazing to see the footage you and your team got. You were embedded with firefighters on what turned out to be the deadliest day in California fire history. This happened with the Camp and the Woolsey fires, destroying thousands of structures in Malibu and Paradise, California, where 88 people tragically died. And can you talk about the process involved in getting this footage? I mean, it's so devastating to see the footage, to remember all of that, and then to hear some of these 911 calls of people saying that they were burning in their homes. I mean, just devastating.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult, traumatic, tragic stuff. Yes, so we wanted to understand the whole story. And I did feel that it was important for people to understand quite how horrifying it is for people who are caught up in these fires, and also quite how much pressure it's putting on firefighters who were also suffering from PTSD. And it's just horrific stuff. And so I didn't want to kind of gratuitously shock people with how awful it is, but I did feel that there were important clues and understandings about how these fires actually go down, that people needed to be informed and then sort of understand why these solutions are so important. So as we set about to make it, as I mentioned, I'd actually started working in the Thomas Fire. And during that time, I'd figured out that you can embed with firefighters. And actually in California, they allow journalists to go behind fire lines and report from there. So we were able to really go into incidents, and we were also able to ride along with amazing firefighters. And it was incredibly eye-opening, but it also was sort of a preparation in retrospect period for when these deadliest, still the deadliest fires ever in California, which happened in Paradise, and sort of the worst week ever of fire, which was the Paradise Malibu incident, which was sort of one incident driven by the same sort of wind event, one in Northern California, one in Southern California, that took place November 8th, 2018. And that was a devastating day where 88 people were killed. And because we had already been filming, we had been able to actually just really hop in with the firefighters that we already knew and get into those incidents right away and really witness a great deal. And also we were able to meet a lot of people who had been filming their own material, and they would sort of airdrop me the videos that they had shot themselves, which were really their own, you know, very close encounters with the fires as they'd been inside them, thinking they were going to die, or really confronting this monstrous fire, these monstrous fires, I should say, because it was Malibu and Paradise that we focused on. And so we really had this incredible sort of array of just the most frightening sort of footage I've ever seen. And I've been a filmmaker a while and seen a lot of incredibly powerful material. And we also, from talking to the first responders, knew that there was a lot of, they were very devastated. I mean, what they'd witnessed that day and even the people who were back at the dispatch just listening to these calls were utterly traumatized by what they'd heard. And we were able, through the Freedom of Information Act, to apply and get these phone calls and also the radio traffic from that day. So you can really hear the calls and also the interactions and really get a sense of what it's like on the ground and for people. And through the sort of craft of editing, so we're able to really put together a whole picture of what it was like on the ground. And what was also amazing was that we were able to, I talked to so many people. I was so sort of, I felt so driven and responsible to tell the story and get it right that we'd actually talk to so many people that sometimes, I would talk to the nurse who had been helping a woman who had just had a C-section and she couldn't walk. And she had a brand new baby that had just been born, but she was still, wearing a catheter and she couldn't actually feel her legs. So she was stuck in a traffic jam as a passenger in a car. But when the passenger of the car got out, she couldn't get out and run too. And then the passenger came back, for example, and said, well, if the fire comes, what do you want me to do? And this new mom had to say, well, take my baby and run. It was that dreadful of an incident. But what we were able to do was sort of piece together these different people. There was another dozer driver who had come along and rescued a whole bunch of people, maybe 100 people who were trapped in their cars because there were burning cars blocking the road. And he had enormous danger to himself against all the training that he'd received with the windows on his dozer shield cracked. He actually drove into the incident and smashed the cars out of the way. And so people were able to escape. And so we were able to interview him as well as the people that he was rescuing. So it was kind of amazing putting the pieces together with the different people and also the pieces of footage together and also the radio traffic. So you really got a very sort of 360 sort of sense of the whole incident. It was a remarkable journey, actually.
Yeah, you make us feel like we were actually there, which is really incredible. Let's talk about the different pieces of the puzzle that you put together. Again, climate change, logging, housing, development. So let's start with climate change. In the film, you interview a number of experts. Let's talk about what they told you about how climate change is making these fires worse. What did you learn from these experts?
I wanted to learn exactly how climate change was impacting the fires. It wasn't enough to say climate change is making it worse. That seemed right. Sort of a bit vague to me. I thought, well, let's actually kind of find out a little bit more than that so I can really understand it. And I learned some interesting things. I learned that, yes, the nighttime temperatures have gone up 2 degrees, actually. And what that means for firefighting is a lot. Because traditionally, firefighters have kind of made their gains on the fire at night. So night is when they're able to, with the cooler temperatures and less wind, they're able to sort of get their advantage over the fire and beat it back. And the daytime tends to be when they lose ground. But now with these hotter temperatures at night, it's harder. The fires are still going at night, and that has really made a difference. It's also, of course, that we're getting more extreme incidents. So as the temperature goes up, it's not just the temperature goes up. It's also that things become more extreme. So we're seeing these terrible, more extreme events. And those extreme events also drive extreme winds. And it's these extreme events that tend to really be incredibly dangerous for fires. As we know very well, if you live in a fire area, the wind's your greatest enemy. It's terrifying. When the winds get up, the firefighters just on edge. They know what that means because these winds are just blow torches and fans, and they fan these flames and really, really drive the incidents. And if you get a spark with wind, that is a terrible combination. And actually that's what's happening, is because traditionally in California, usually the winds would come, the seasonal winds would come in the fall when the rains had already started to come. But now with more extreme variations in the climate, if the winds get up, or those serious winds in the fall start happening before you've had this you know, everything being damped down by the rain, that's when you get really serious trouble as well. And so, and the extreme, and that's in Southern California, and in Northern California, you've got the drought. So it really is a bunch of different ways that the climate change is really affecting things, for sure. And we've seen such extremes. I couldn't believe the heat dome we saw, and we're seeing all these winds, and of course now we're in drought, that vegetation is extremely dry, and that's a real recipe for disaster.
Zeke Lunder, who's a geographer, was so interesting in the film. He said that even without climate change, paradise was going to burn. Of course, climate change is a major factor, but it is not the only contributor.
That's right. I couldn't believe it when he said that. And I was really intrigued to hear, well, why? And he explained to me, and then many other experts explained to me as well, because this is apparently well known. It's just I didn't know it before, is that we've been suppressing fires. So what's been happening is probably because of people like me coming along and saying, put the fires out, right? And also because we had started to have timber crops, you know, once we started to have big lumber operations and we wanted to protect those. And we had a couple of big devastating fires at the beginning of the 20th century. And we wanted to just put out all the fires. We had this idea that you could suppress all fires. It's called fire suppression. It seemed very sensible. You just put out all the fires. Don't let them get started. And there was even a rule called the 10 a.m. rule in firefighting in the US that meant every blaze, you had to get it put out by 10 a.m. the next morning. That way it would never get started. Now, the problem with that is that when you don't have regular fires in areas that are adapted to have burned regularly forever, you're going to build up that fuel. Naturally, all the places that burn have had a cycle where they do occasionally have fires coming through. And what those fires do is that they'll kind of clear out the ladder fuels, they'll clear out the small stuff, and they'll often leave the big trees or the crowns, but they'll just also reduce all the fuels overall so that when the next fire comes along, it won't have such a bunch of fuel to go on. It won't have ladder fuels, which means all the low to the ground stuff and the little branches that build up. That can, you know, really spread the fire up to the crowns and really spread the fire. So in, it used to be, and I didn't even believe this, I looked at old photographs. It used to be that it was what they call more of a savanna, where you had bigger trees, wider spaced apart. You didn't have these thick forests where there's tons of trees and tons of stuff from all the way from the ground level all the way up. It used to be that you could ride horses through the forests of California, for example. And there are all these accounts of early people coming through and noticing how you had these incredible areas that you could ride through the trees. And now, of course, you try to ride through a forest and there's good luck with that. You just couldn't even, you know, the skinniest person couldn't squeak through without getting scratched up, you know, because the forest is so, so thick. So this fire suppression has seemed like a great idea, but has left us with these enormously thick forests and tremendous fuel loads, so that when you do get an ignition, it will have so much fuel. And if you combine that ignition with a bunch of wind, you have a major voracious fire that's going to come through and tear things up and burn so much hotter than they've ever burned before. So, for example, what we're seeing is trees like the giant sequoia. Now, the giant sequoia is the kind of poster child. It's a poster tree of California. It's this beautiful, enormous tree that lives for so long. And you can see from its bark rings that it's lived through, I don't know, 50 forest fires. And in fact, its seed pods aren't even cued to open. It doesn't even sort of spread its seeds until a fire comes along. And the fire heat melts the seed pod to release the seed. And the seed lands on this lovely ground that has been cleared by the fire and is full of rich nutrients from the fire. And that's how the giant sequoia will have a new seed sprout to grow a new tree. Now, these trees are enormously tall and majestic and fantastic and sort of are great prizes. We flock to the national parks to see these. And however, in recent years, they've been dying in fires, they've been burned. How can the ultimate fire-adapted species be burning? And that's because the fires are burning much hotter and taller than before. And why? Because the fuel has been allowed to build up. So if you don't have these little fires, which sounds scary because I was someone who just was a chicken and didn't like fire at all. And actually, the very first time I visited a national park with the giant sequoias, there was actually a little fire. They were deliberately setting a little fire, and I didn't like it. I didn't like the smoke. I didn't like the fact that there was – I thought, this is crazy. They're going to get it out of control, even though it was sort of March. And actually, now I know that was a very sensible thing to be doing. They were just burning little 6-inch flame lengths to kind of just clear out the forest floor in a very safe time of year to burn in the early spring. And now I can see why they were doing that. But at the time I had this reaction, like, I don't like the smoke. I'm in a national park. I'm here for the trees. What if the fire gets out of hand and it endangers the trees? I had it all backwards. And I think it's easy to do. As we have one person in the film talk about how it's actually like opposite world in the film, because some things you think might help, actually, when you learn a little bit more, don't help at all. And so fire suppression, which seemed like a wonderful idea, and we had Smokey the Bear, telling us just don't, it's our responsibility, nobody start a forest fire. But the trouble is, of course, that we can't prevent all the ignitions. We'd like to be able to say there's never going to be a spark in the forest. And in that case, fire suppression might have worked, because we could just kind of keep growing forever, right? We wouldn't be able to ride our horses through the forest, but at least we wouldn't have any fires. The trouble is, there will always be ignitions. And even if it's not a human error, there'll be lightning. But there has been human error. There have been utility companies. There have been gender reveal parties. There have been two major fires that have been caused by gender reveal parties, actually, which is kind of an amazing, shocking detail I learned. And so you have all these kinds of ignitions. And when there's an ignition and there's all that fuel, you're just in a world of trouble.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Lucy Walker, director of the new documentary, Bring Your Own Brigade. We talked about the climate crisis, and after a break, we will learn more about logging and the history of the timber boom in California, which is a major factor in these fires. Again, experts say it does not have to be this way. If we do take action, this does not have to be our new normal. You can watch the trailer for Bring Your Own Brigade at yourcallradio.org. It opens in Bay Area theaters today and will stream on the CBS News app and Paramount on August 20th. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with Lucy Walker, director of the new documentary, Bring Your Own Brigade. Such an important film that looks at why wildfires are increasing in number and severity. And she talks to a number of experts about what can be done to lessen the staggering death and destruction they cause. Bring Your Own Brigade opens in Bay Area theaters today. It'll stream on the CBS News and Paramount apps on August 20th. So, Lucy, let's spend a little bit more time talking about the timber boom and logging. Such important history in here. You report that the big companies from Minnesota and Michigan ran out of trees, and so they looked to California. And then these timber barons acquired the best timber land, and there was a big interest in getting the Forest Service to put out all of these fires as soon as they started. Such important history. You also really explore Sierra Pacific, which is owned by Red Emerson, the largest private landowner in California, one of the richest people in the world. He's a huge Republican donor, especially to the Agricultural Committee. He owns 1.9% of California, making him the third largest landowner in the country.
That's right. I didn't know any of this stuff. And if you've ever done construction, you might have recognized the Sierra Pacific Industries logo on the lumber. But I had no idea. It's kind of interesting, I suppose, that, you know, the timber and logging industries aren't sort of very sort of, I guess, exciting to report on, or things that people, you know, it's not the Kardashians, right? So people aren't really paying much attention to this stuff, and quite what an incredible business it turned out to be in logging. But I had learned that a huge amount of these areas were under the management of a logging company. And I was very interested because as a solution to the fire problem, there had been calls under the last administration for more logging. And my first response had been, well, maybe that's right. You know, these trees are burning, and these trees are burning down towns like Paradise. And, you know, we've just seen the terrible tragedy that just happened in Greenville. And these beautiful towns are burning, and there are these trees nearby, and why don't we log more? And that could help. And then when I really dug into it, I learned that no, actually, these areas had been completely logged, and there were really a huge amount of the area, including the area that the campfire had burned through incredibly quickly on its way to Paradise, where 85 people were killed. So there was a very quick fire, and the reason so many people killed was because they couldn't evacuate in time because the fire burned so fast. And so looking at where the fire burned in the first few hours and really paying attention to what land it burned through, I learned that a big chunks, maybe almost 50% when you look at the map, was under the management of a logging company. And actually what's more is all of it had burned in a previous fire 10 years before the campfire, and had been subsequently all logged. And then the areas owned by Sierra Pacific, which was almost 50%, had been replanted as dense tree plantations. And they were about 8 years old, these trees. And the trouble with those young tree plantations is they really burn very hot. They plant very close together, and the crowns are all interlocked, and the fire just whips through there. And I was astounded when I learned all this, because there'd been a great deal of reporting about the campfire, but nobody had actually looked at the forest composition where the fire had burned through in those first hours. And it was by actually talking to amazing local geographer Zeke Linder that I kind of got a tip off to look at the maps and started to really understand that logging actually wasn't a solution, even though it might seem that way. And the more I dug into it, the more I learned that logging has lots of negative impacts. There's lots of problems for these fires. And the logging trucks spread invasive species on their tires. And so we're seeing this, the nature of our landscape change from species that were actually pretty fire resilient and pretty helpful to us to terribly flammable species. Like cheatgrass, for example, apparently is just terrible for spreading fire. And that's what the logging trucks are spreading. We also have much hotter and without the shade. We don't have it broken up by, you'd think that the old trees that have fallen down would be like big fire risks, but actually they kind of act like sinks and sponges. They have a lot of moisture and decay in them, and they kind of actually almost act as breaks. And they also, when they plant trees, they have to plant them very densely, which is a rule intended to make sure that people actually plant after they log. And that seems like a good idea. But again, the unintended negative consequence is that you then have to go through and thin. Once they get to a certain age, you have to plant a number of seeds. But now that we're really good at raising all those seeds to grow up into trees, and we're suppressing all the fire, they all survive. So then we have to go back in and cut them down because there's too many trees that are planted. And when they cut them down, they leave what's called slash, which is all the sort of debris, the kind of matchsticks laying around. So you have these very different sort of areas than natural forest. And it turns out that they're way more flammable. And we have these huge swathes of these areas that are really, you know, the heart of logging. I mean, just an enormous amount up and down the western United States of areas that are incredible for forestry and logging industries. And I think that's a fact that just hasn't been reported on. And I'm really interested to see some other reporters as well following up. But I was really cheered actually to talk to Sierra Pacific Industries when they said that they're going to change what they plant around the town of Paradise, because they were learning themselves that, you know, these plantations turn out to be very flammable. And as more fires come through, they're losing their crops too. And I hope that that's going to be prompting a really good rethink of what the logging industry is planting and how they're doing it, because they're burning up too.
Right. So you had some really interesting visuals in the film of these young trees that are younger than 10 years old. It's so near the area of Paradise. And experts told you when a fire comes through, it just spreads so incredibly fast. It rips through the areas, like you said, like they're matchsticks. One expert told you that these clear cuts are basically ignition points.
That's exactly right. And I was just stunned to go up there with various people to the ignition point of the campfire, which, by the way, is also the ignition point for what's burning today, the Dixie Fire, because the Dixie Fire and the campfire actually were buried. They started exactly the same place. They started off Feather River Canyon off of Highway 70 on Camp Creek Road. And so we now have this current fire that's burning that started in exactly the same spot, and I've been there. And when there were several people and they showed me the nature of that landscape, and I was really shocked. And in the film, you can hear me actually getting very shocked. I'm not normally in my films, but there's a couple of moments in this film where I put myself in because my reaction, I think, says more than anything. And my reaction to be up there was to be very shocked, because when you see that landscape, you understand that it's industrial forestry at its maximum. There is nothing natural about the forest where the campfire and the Dixie Fire ignited. It's really shocking, and it's also really shocking to see how hot the fire burned through. It was an inferno. The crust on the ground is just unbelievable. It's not like a normal forest fire, and I thought that was really just terrifying. And then you could look down and see the community of Concow, where 12 people out of 300 residents were killed, and then you could look over the ridge and see Paradise and understood that this was the landscape the fire had whipped through. And to see this area where all the trees you could see were exactly the same height. They were all 8 or 9 years old. You can tell by their height, and you can count actually how old they are because they have a branch for every year. So you can literally kind of just see this. It's almost like a kind of when you grow vegetables, you know, it's not like a natural forest. It's just kind of rows of trees exactly the same age planted in rows. It's not anything like a normal forest. And when I understood that, especially by being there and the film takes you there, I think it's very powerful.
So Sierra Pacific decided not to replant those young trees. But you have to wonder, where are the politicians in all of this? Why have they allowed this to go on for so long?
Well, that's right. I think on the bright side, I always like to look on the bright side. I'm going to say that I do think that the problem is coming into focus now, and I have hope that in future we will do things differently. I think there is a lot of cause for hope. I think that you can't look at the Dixie Fire burning today, for example, and not want to do more. And I do think that politicians are starting to learn that we need to really understand how we're managing our landscape and maybe have tough conversations with the public and maybe start to understand it's very difficult to think about how we can do things differently. But unfortunately, given what we're seeing, we're going to have to. I mean, unfortunately, if these problems are going to continue, we're just in such a world of pain here. I mean, the Dixie Fire is not out, and it's almost 500,000 acres already. And the town of Greenville lost, you know, the people in my film are now evacuated again. The Paradise is, you know, under threat again from the Dixie Fire. And it's been less than 3 years and people are so excited to build their homes again. But what are we doing differently? Because those homes are just going to burn again. And fire used to come through regularly, but now it's coming through all the time. And we get counties like Lake County seem to now burn every year, and people are losing insurance and so much destruction. And, you know, it's really, the problem is here and sort of, yeah.
Well, to your point, in the film, we learn that 40 to 50% of new housing in California is built in hazardous fire areas. 40 to 50%. And experts told you that our society is growing so much, it's really pushing us to the fringes of these areas, and more people will die. One person said, why do we approve building in these dangerous areas? Well, it's all about money. Tell us more about what you learned about this, because you went to council meetings in Malibu and in Paradise. And at the Malibu meeting, a number of homeowners just said, can we just build faster? Can we just get rid of all this permitting? And then in Paradise, there were building codes for fire-safe homes, proven steps that people can take to make their homes safer. And yet we saw council person after council person voted against things like 5 feet fire breaks, which is a critical factor in whether homes burn or not. So these are the kinds of conversations that really need to be had, is where should people build and how should these homes be built?
Exactly. And this is something that we could really do stuff about. But are we doing it? And even just the San Francisco Chronicle, I think last week, issued a study saying that even during this pandemic, as people have been moving out of San Francisco, where are they going? They're going to this area called the WUI, the Wildland Urban Interface. And this is an area where we live next to wildlands and we live in fire-prone areas. And the I think net migration to zip codes that are in fire-prone areas jumped by 40,000 in 2020. So 40,000 new people are now in the path of the fire just in 1 year. And these areas tend to be these beautiful areas that are also a little bit more affordable than the big cities that have been so unaffordable. So, of course, we all want to move there. But the trouble is that they're incredibly flammable. And some places in particular are like wind tunnels that burn all the time. And as more people move in, they may not be aware of the history of these fires. You know, people are very shocked to see that this neighborhood that looks kind of suburban is actually, you know, very fire prone, and maybe even the previous residents of the property were killed in fires, but you may not even know that unless you really educate yourself. And I was really shocked to learn that. And when you get into it, the amazing thing that we can do is affect how we build. I had no idea, and I think most people don't, that how you build your house makes such a big difference about whether or not it's going to survive if a fire comes through. There was a fire in the Latuna fire that had an incredible home survival rate. And why? It's because they'd actually had codes that really went above and beyond the standard codes for the wildland urban interface, and had extra requirement that you did 5 feet of what they call defensible space. So nothing flammable up against your house for 5 feet. And that made such a difference that almost all of the homes survived. And in Paradise, what they had some new building codes come in about 15 years ago, that the Wildland Urban Interface building code, I think, came in 2008. And so the houses built after that, 51% of them survived, whereas the houses built before that code were only 9% of them survived. So you can see it makes a huge, huge difference about whether or not your home's going to survive. And in Paradise, there's a town council meeting that was very shocking, where you see the fire chief and the mayor and some experts kind of imploring the residents to embrace some new codes that would really help if a fire comes along, because it is going to come along. And as I said, unfortunately, it could even be the Dixie fire that comes along right now. And you see them explaining all the science and quite what a difference it makes. And yet people aren't getting it, and they just want to have things the way that they were before, even things that don't cost them any money, like the way that, you know, where your gutters can be, and leaves do stick up in the gutters. And do we really want gutters? If it's a choice between having gutters and your house burning down, I would think that people might say, you know what, I'll let the gutters go. I'm just going to have a house that doesn't burn. But no, you see the real pressure that the residents put on the seven council members, and the seven council members vote down these suggestions to make the home safer, which privately they told me that they really believed would be very wise to implement. So I kind of caught this moment where sort of see that we know what the problem is, we know what the solution is, but it's very difficult politically to implement it, because when you've got people in crisis, they just want to rebuild. And we get it. You know, your heart breaks for these people. If I could have gotten there and rebuilt them a house myself, I would have done. The problem is that if we're not talking about how we're rebuilding and where we're rebuilding, we're maybe not doing anyone any favors, because, you know, who wants to build a house that is not going to be insurable and it's going to burn down next year? You know, are we really, you know, helping when we're not having these difficult conversations and saying, well, I know we want to rebuild right here in the same place, the same way, but what can we do to make sure that we're a little bit safer, because these fires are happening? And so we talked to an architect in Malibu, and he points out all the structures that burned, and people want to have a Tuscan villa with these little eaves that stick out. But unfortunately, the embers get right up in the eaves, and that's how they burn. So you learn that if a house is in the fire's way, it won't automatically burn. It's going to be some very specific features you have on that house that are going to make all the difference. And I think that's something that people who are homeowners and residents can really listen to their firefighters. The firefighters know all this stuff. And, you know, the firefighters are incredible, and they will help you. You know, they'll really help you understand, because they know exactly what's going on. But somehow I don't think that the public really understands that how much difference it makes, even though it really is rock solid science. There's no doubt that this is absolutely the way to go, is to really look at how we're building.
We're speaking today with Lucy Walker, director of the new documentary, Bring Your Own Brigade, which opens today in Bay Area theaters. You can find the trailer online. Lucy, we only have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk about the indigenous history that you bring out in the film and the indigenous people that you interview. Indigenous people, and we've done shows about this, have burned historically to protect their village areas. They burned around structures to protect these structures. And as you report in the film, when Europeans arrived, they banned these native practices. And then you look at what happened during the gold rush. In 1849, thousands and thousands of people were pouring in to California. And when fires happened, they wanted to put them out ASAP, just like the Forest Service. So that history is also so incredibly important, because this goes back to settlement and just what happened when white settlers came in and banned these practices that worked for many, many, many years.
That's exactly right. And I had this moment when I realized that I was a European that had come to California and seen these fires and thought, put that thing out. You know, it's not supposed to be there. We don't have fire on our landscape. And that was because in Northern Europe, where I'm from, we don't have fire in our landscape. And why is that? Because it's not a fire-adapted landscape. We don't have dry seasons. The fuel isn't going to burn through regularly. In the UK, where I grew up, that's the way. And I think that fundamental mistake the European settlers came, when they came, they didn't see the incredible wisdom and technology and mastery that the indigenous people had working with the land, that they were fire farmers, that they, you know, use fire in all these different ways, but really smart ways, much smarter than we've been. You know, we're kind of young and getting the wrong ideas and the first ideas about how to manage the landscape, but they had plenty of experience, and they really had the science down, and they lived actually much more safely and harmoniously, it seems, with the landscape. And the tragedy is that we've been ignoring that wisdom and banning those fire practices and suppressing these efforts. And even today, you know, meeting these incredible tribal practitioners who know so much and do practice cultural burning, prescribed burning, controlled burning, there are different words for it. They, you know, talk about how they're just not being listened to, and, you know, how sad that is, but how incredible it is when you do get to burn and clean out a landscape and make it more protected and safe for when the next fire that burns through, there won't be that fuel there. It is difficult to find the, you know, it is a uphill battle to have prescribed burns in today's age. Nobody likes the smoke. It's quite expensive, and there's a lot of red tape, and it's definitely kind of difficult to do controlled burns. However, again, how difficult is the situation that we're in? And can we please have these difficult conversations about explaining to people that actually this way that seems counterintuitive, it doesn't seem right to set a fire, to put out a fire, or to make fires more easily to put out, you have to set a few fires. That doesn't seem on face value, easy to accept. But that is the reality. And our indigenous people here in these areas really had this information and technology all along. And I really hope that we can really listen to them and gain from their incredible wisdom. And I think that was an incredible part of the story for me, was learning that history. And again, just realizing that my own role as a European being ignorant was actually part of the story.
Well, Lucy, it's really an incredible film. You explore so many layers to this. And again, it's important to note that the experts you interviewed say it does not have to be this way. If we take action, this doesn't have to be our new normal. Can you just tell us quickly what you're doing to really get this out to as many people as possible? Because you need a 2-hour film like this to really understand what's going on here.
It's a lot, but the film is full of people. I think that it's not just information. I think you follow the stories of the residents, and it's a kind of really emotional and amazing people that you meet. So hopefully it's a movie that it's not dry, kind of talking headsy. It's really, it's a very emotional, intimate journey, I think, with the people affected.
It's fantastic. But in our soundbite world, it's just hard to connect all the dots. You really need a film like this to really understand what we're facing and how we can, right.
And I'm doing actually some special premieres and screenings with some news anchors, and they've been saying, oh my gosh, I've been covering this story, but I can only do it in 2 minutes. And so all you can really show is the flame burning the house, and this is the story I've been wanting to tell because there is this information. So it's going to be out. It's great. Right now it's in a lot of theaters. So check your local listings. It's called Bring Your Own Brigade and you can find it. And then from August 20th, it's going to be on the Paramount Plus and also on the CBSN app, which is actually free. So everyone's going to be able to just download that CBSN app and watch it on there. And I'm really happy about that. It's going to be super accessible to everybody.
That is fantastic. Well, Lucy, thanks to you and your team for making this incredible documentary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I so appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Lucy Walker is director of Bring Your Own Brigade, and I hope you can share it with friends and family. So many people need to see this film. It opens in Bay Area theaters today. And as Lucy said, it'll stream on the CBSN and Paramount Plus apps on August 20th. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.